Okay, welcome everyone to this seminar entitled Translating World Literature. It might also have been entitled Translating the Classics. Two speakers, Japan and Russia. The first speaker is Russell Tyler.
Royal.
Is it Russell?
Oh, sorry, Royal. Sorry, sorry, Royal.
This is some water.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Royal was professor of Japanese at the Australian National University until his retirement in the year 2000. He's translated extensively from Japanese, most notably the Tale of Genji, published by Viking in 2001, and the Tale of the Heike, published by Penguin in 2012. The Tale of the Heike received not only excellent reviews, but also the Lois Roth Award for translation of a literary work administered by the American Modern Language Association. And I'd like to quote the beginning of the committee's statement. The Tale of the Heike is a historically important epic that is not well known to the general public. This beautiful and painstaking edition represents a significant contribution to bringing it to the attention it deserves. Royal Tyler's translation continues his great contribution to making classical Japanese literature accessible to English language readers, managing to be scholarly and gripping, I'll just repeat that, scholarly and gripping, and making of the tale's very distant and different world something perfectly alive, rich, and with a feeling of completeness. End of quote. And I'd also like to quote from a two-page review of that translation in the London Review of Books, 21st of November last year. Tyler is the most prominent translator since Arthur Whaley and Edward Seidensticker to take on the Sisyphean task of rendering Japan's vast classical literature into accessible English. And Royal is going to talk about the challenge of bringing the tale to life in accessible English. Royal.
The Tale of the Heike is not unknown in English, but it's extremely difficult to translate in a manner that, in such a manner as to elicit the kind of words that Brian just read to us. The reason is that this language, the medieval Japanese, is so very, very distant in some very fundamental ways from English. Some years ago, I read a review of a new translation, or two volumes, new translation of Proust in the New York Review of Books, in which the reviewer, Andrea Simon, complained that these new translators did not sufficiently cleave to the structure and cadence of Proust's original sentences. And I thought, my God, isn't it what a wonderful world it is that you can actually make that complaint in public and not sound foolish. Having translated The Tale of Genji, which is the great classic work of 11th century Japan, the idea of translating a long prose work from that language into English hewing to the structure and cadence of the original sounded to me absolutely impossibly far-fetched. If I had tried to do it, that language has its genius, and I think it's very beautiful in the original, but if I had tried to convey that beauty in that distinction in English, nobody would have read more than a page. It's impossible. So this evening I want to talk about this distance. My theme will be this distance in the case of the Tale of the Heike and, if I get there, the medieval Japanese theater, the Noh Theater, which I'm sure many of you have heard of. So here's the title of it and the and the translation and the words in the title in Japanese. Now this work was in the version that I translated was written down in 1371. It is not, this version is not by any means the only one extant. There are two lines of text. One is the reading line, and the other is the performance line. The reading line has essentially the same material. It is vastly bigger, and it is much less literarily effective. The performance line, exemplified by the so-called kakuichibon, is the one that has always commanded attention and is by far the best known for excellent reason. It makes an almost complete literary whole. It is, in my opinion, shaped and very consciously formed by an informing intelligence. The thing about, and it tells, I should say, that it, the Tale of the Heike tells the story of the wars between the Taira and the Minamoto clans, they're usually called, commonly called, in the late 12th century in Japan. The Taira, in Japanese is horrendously complicated as a language, and there are all kinds of different readings of the same characters, so that Heike means the house of Taira. Hei is also read Taira. So this is the fundamental epic of Japan, really. A work of great power and excellence that has made this conflict truly immortal. And the great difficulty of translating it has to do with the nature of its language. Now, Ryan mentioned that I translated the Tale of Genji, which probably many of you have heard of, and some of you will have read in one translation or another. The Tale of Genji is written in prose. And so you can translate it into prose, at least, as I said. The flavor of the prose is in fact very different in effective English from the flavor in 11th century Japanese, but at least it's still prose. The Tale of the Heike was sung in ways that I can't possibly describe but here, but don't try to imagine anything that you know of as singing unless you know a little bit about the subject. Vocalized in extremely complex ways. In a European language, it would have been, well, a great deal of it would have been in verse. However, medieval Japanese, in fact, Japanese, really until now, but I'm talking about medieval Japanese, cannot sustain narrative verse. The language is simply not equipped to do it. So, mine isn't the first translation of Heike no Monogatari into English. But all the others, I think there were three, have been into prose, straight prose. This is a problem. It's actually a very interesting translation problem, which I can only just touch the surface of. But in my opinion, and I think judging from the reception of my translation, prose just doesn't work. It doesn't matter what you do with it. To translate the Tale of the Hague into English prose, it is not going to work. So I translated most of it into verse. I need to move some slides along. That's the title. This is the hero or the villain of, by the way, of the Tale of the Hague, Taira no Kiyomori. This is an early 19th century illustration. I'm sorry, it's not clear, but he does look like a fairly mean character, which he was. Now, this is the... You can't read it from here, even if you could read Japanese, you couldn't read it from here, I don't think. But anyway, this is the opening passage. It's the opening lines of the Tale of the Hague are among perhaps the most famous in Japanese literature. Certainly there is none more famous. And even if you can't read it, you can see that this is printed as a block in prose. All editions are... It looks like prose. It's been treated as prose. It's much more complicated than that. This edition actually gives indications of voicing. And these, I was hoping to have a pointer. The little character up there, this here in between the lines, there's another one, indicates changes. There's another one up at the top of the third from the left, indicate changes of voicing. All of those, there are distinctions between these kinds of voicing are not possible to make in English, but all those I treated under a category that I called song. And this is what song looks like in my translation. Can I go back there? Yeah. I'll just speak for you these extremely famous lines, let's see. Here we go. The Jetavana temple bells ring the passing of all things. Twin sal trees, white in full flower, declare the great man's certain fall. Well, in Japanese, it's very different. Dion shōja no kane no koe, shōgyō bujō no hibiki ari, shara sōjū no hana no iro, jōsha hissui no kotowari wo arasu. And that's just as normally spoken in Japanese. The way Japanese would be spoken, would be broken down for performance purposes, makes the static quality of the language even clearer. The first two lines, let me back up a bit. The poem starts in the standard Japanese poetic meter, 5-7-5-7-5 syllables. That's the meter that breaks down immediately if you try to continue it. So the first couple of lines, if I count them on my fingers, Gion Musho Woja no 7, Kane no Koe 5, Shogyo Omujo no 7, Hibiki Ari 5 again. That's regular, although it doesn't sound like Japanese poetry. But immediately, the verse breaks down. And for my purposes, the main thing about it is that this is an extremely static-sounding language. What I set out to do immediately to translate Hegel was to give it forward movement in English. It has none, in my estimation, in Japanese, even though the story was forward. So I gave it, when I first set out to see whether I could really do this, I just charged into translating this famous opening passage, and when I finished it, I thought, yes, I think I can. And I guess I don't have time to read any of this, but I think that my translation has a kind of a momentum that is not easy to feel from the Japanese original, but without which the work is not appealing in English and doesn't actually, therefore, convey what there is to convey of the original. In other words, translation, as we all know, as you all know, is not just words. It goes a lot deeper than that. Now, this is another passage. I'm not going to get very far with this talk, am I? One of the critical moments in the tale of the Heike is when one of the sons of the great villain Taiyama Kiyomori burns down the temples of Nara in the wars between the Taira and the Minamoto. And I don't know if some of you may have been to Japan and been to Todaiji, the great Eastern temple in Nara, and seen the Daibutsu there, the great Buddha. Well, what you see, the Buddha that you see today, was recast in the early 13th century. It is not the original one. Todaiji dates from 752. The whole building burned down because of these wars. And this was the ghastly crime, the single most ghastly crime committed by the Heike clan. So this is what this passage looks like in, or part of it, in the original in a movable type edition. Again, all you can see is it is printed as a block. And here's one of these indications in this edition. I mentioned different types of vocalization, elaborately ornamented vocalization, which I lump together as what I call song. There's a kind of recitative delivery too that is called kudoki. And this actually indicates hiron is in kudoki. There's a third type of delivery which is called shirakoe, or plain speech. And so this is what I did with that passage in translation, with the wonderful cooperation of Penguin, Viking Penguin in New York, that made a pretty beautiful book of this. This is song. This is speech. This is recitative. And this is song again. So, the speech, these changes of pace and diction break up the narrative. Again, if you translate it into solid prose in English, there's no variation at all. But doing it this way, you get changes of pace, changes of diction, and a variety that I think brings the text to life. I don't have much time at all, but anyway, I'll just read this account of these words that tell of the actual catastrophe and the people who died in it. Ancient monks unable to walk, great scholars, cherished acolytes, women and children fled pell-mell into the grounds of Kofubuji, another temple. Over 1,000 people at Todaiji climbed to the second floor of the Great Buddha Hall, and, lest the enemy follow them there, took up the ladders, devouring fire, swept right straight into their huddled mass. I can't read it either. Sinners burning in boundless hell never uttered such hideous screams. This was the great crime of the Taira and the son who perpetrated this crime. In the end, of course, came to a sticky end. This is an early 19th century illustration of the burden of the great Buddha, which I have in my translation. Now this is a third passage which I wanted to talk about. I'm fond of my translation of it. Again, what you're seeing is the usual sort of solid rock of prose. What looks like prose. Let me see, where are we? But I'll just use as an example of how I gave the language a kind of forward movement, which doesn't, Japanese works in different ways, but which simply doesn't happen the way it's written in Japanese. This is a disaster during which the Taira forces are tricked into dashing down a steep ravine, they all end up falling on top of each other, and it's a massacre. It's called the Kurikara Otoshi, the route down Kurikara Ravine. So from here down purple the father, down the son, down the brothers, elder than younger, down the lord, his retainer behind him, men piling on horses, horses on men, over and over, till mountain riders, 70,000 of the Heike, edge to edge, choked the yawning ravine. Springs ran blood, the dead lay in mounds. To this day, so it is told, arrow strike nicks and sword cuts mark the rocks up and down. All I'm saying is that this is far beyond sort of verse form and style. This is a complete recasting of the original work into language, which I think works better in English. And I did sort of say I was going to talk a little bit about the Noh theater, but it was already 7 o'clock. Maybe I'll say a few words. I've translated a lot of the Noh theater as well, and I'm sure many of you have heard of it. This is the 15th, early 15th century theater. This is a manuscript. Here's a manuscript by Zayami, the classic genius of the Noh theater. Just to show you what it looks like, this is all in the Japanese phonetic script katakana. It too looks like a solid block of text. Of course, most of this is poetry. Here's what wrong button. This is what a modern performance score looks like of a Noh play. This is what people study Noh singing with. And this is of the play Nishikigi, the painted wands, if you call it. And yes, I really have very little time, but and you can't read any of that. So I'll just say, this, by the way, is this is a performance score of Nishikiki that I bought recently in Tokyo. And this is a book in which I've translated in a lot of other ways. This is my fourth book of war translations. The difficulty of translating no poetry is quite different from that of translating the language of the tale of the Heike. No poetry is founded and rooted in a very complex poetic tradition. And and it's so full of allusions to earlier poetry that trying to get those things into English so that they make any kind of sense at all is quite a challenge. But well, I think I can't dwell on this one, and you can't read it, so maybe I'd better heal the put into those of them.
So thank you.
Haiku poetry didn't even appear until the 17th century, and of course it's very short, and I seem to have ended up translating very long works, so no, there's no relationship.
Could you say a little bit more about the difficulty of Japanese sustaining extended narrative in verse?
Yes, I could try. Japanese poetry is very, what's defined as poetry in the classical tradition is very narrowly defined. The longest poems in Japanese date from the 7th or 8th century. And that long poem form, which was never very long anyway, fell out of use. All the masterpieces of it date from 7th or 8th century. Japanese poetry has always tended toward brevity. The classic form is not 17 syllables, but 31. And it has strictly defined rules for diction, vocabulary, usage. And it's these rules exclude everything political, social, military. It would be absolutely impossible to narrate a battle in classical Japanese, in the language of classical Japanese poetry. One of the key features of the Tale of the Heike is that it is in a kind of hybrid Sino-Japanese style, which brings in a lot of Chinese vocabulary and a lot of Chinese exemplary stories, actually. So the Japanese literary tradition backed itself into a corner. It made it impossible to tell a story in the sanctioned language of what the Japanese defined as poetry. It's clear when I talked about the first lines of the Tale of the Heike, they immediately break down into irregular, more and more irregular syllable counts. And by the way, in Japanese poetry, there is no rhyme, there is no meter. none of them. And this happens again and again in the Heike. If a passage of high emotion starts in the 5-7-5-7-5 syllable count meter that's classical, it breaks down immediately. And even the language, even the words used in the opening lines of the Tale of the Heike are not sanctioned in the classical poetic tradition. It's a curious phenomenon. At the same time, musically, the professional performers who performed Heike, which they did all over Japan for centuries, were able, I mean, these people could sing, I'm exaggerating, but they could sing a telephone book. It has no, the music has no relationship to meter or rhyme or anything else that I suppose we would consider fundamental in the European languages. But it's an interesting phenomenon that poetic narrative is impossible in Japanese.
Following on, to what extent did the written text, I guess what I'm driving at is, what's the interaction between the written text and the performed? Draw an illusion between, say, the performance of Homeric poetry and its eventual transcription.
In a sense, to some extent, there sort of isn't any connection. I mean, I think one would assume that Homer sang something that one could understand, and the core of which is conveyed by his verse, a rhythm, a movement. Japanese doesn't work that way at all. The way Heike was sung is, I'm not a musicologist, but from my perspective, unrelated to the features of the text. You can do anything with it in the style of vocalization elaborated by the Heike performers. And this is, I'm really quite ignorant about it. I didn't bring any recordings, but there is one formally initiated Heike performer left in Japan. He received, in the Orthodox tradition, only 6 short pieces. That would be a few pages. His performance, he did not receive the opening passage because it was so powerful and so of such high rank that he would have received it only late in his career, which never happened because his teacher died and he was the last left. However, he has performed it rather reluctantly in a reconstruction by a specialist musicologist. At that rate, it would take months to perform the entire text. It's extremely slow. It's very elaborate. Very difficult to understand. So it's, in short, an interesting example of relationship between written text and performance, about which I can't say much more than that, but it's fairly extreme. It's a huge gap.
Were there any recordings of the
Heike? The last surviving orthodoxly taught performer has recorded his repertoire.
And there's no predecessor recordings?
Oh, well, it was rather a long time ago. No, I don't think so. What's interesting is that there are some performers who the instrument is the biwa, which is a relative, is a member of the lute family, it's the Chinese biwa. That instrument was revived, particularly in Kyushu, in the late 19th century and in the 20th century, and so there are some very, very good performers on it. And they perform certain passages of the Tale of the Heike, for instance, the opening one, and other dramatic passages. Now, this is not the Orthodox transmission. Therefore, it is ripping. It's fascinating. There are some really tremendously dramatic performances. They're available on CD of a few key passages. And I like to think that, regardless of the musicological details, those convey the kind of effect that performance of the Tale of the Heike in the 14th century would have had on audiences. But the performance tradition changed, slowed down, became canned, and essentially died despite a nominal continuity. So it's the people who revived biwa performance who actually can sing it, certain passages anyway, a few passages, in a manner worthy of the text. For me, a performance, however orthodox in terms of transmission, that doesn't grab you is not really very interesting.
I'm just wondering, in terms of the dynamics, in terms of the terminology, you said that the text was written some centuries ago. I don't speak Japanese, so I don't know much about the language, but in terms of translating a text from so long ago, how did you go about, was it easy to find, English equivalents for these Japanese terms from so long ago, or is Japanese constructed in a way that it's less...
I had a great advantage in that I had already, there are a great many. One of the features of the Tale of the Heike is, it mentions a great many people, a great many men particularly, and their titles, and their weapons, and whatnot, of course. I had the great advantage of having already translated rather a lot of classical Japanese literature, particularly the Tale of Genji, for which I had to work out English equivalents of court offices and whatnot. And so I already had that, and it was enormously helpful. Not that it was difficult to do. I'm not the first to try it, but I developed my own vocabulary. I had that vocabulary. When it came to weapons, I think that I did my best, swords, halberds, shields, items of armor, I didn't really try to translate. They have their technical terms in European languages and in Japanese. I think it's, apart from helmet or breastplate, but beyond that, it's really. I had a lot of trouble with the colors of horses. Horses are described. All kinds of things. There seems to be an awful lot of roan horses in Japan. I can't quite figure this out. But it's hard to tell. So I did my best. Put in equivalents that convey something. To what extent they're strictly accurate, I don't know. So, but anyway, I had a lot of this
already under my belt. So the, it took me 2 years to translate this book. I couldn't believe it myself. I just flew, I guess. At every moment, I knew that I was putting into this translation my entire experience and my heart to it.
I was just wondering about the target audience, the target audience that you have in your mind.
Please, I'm sorry.
I want to learn about the target audience of the translation, because English is spoken in different parts of the world, and the target audience in different countries have different familiarity with the Japanese works. So, who was the target audience in your mind, and how did it affect your translation decisions?
The target audience.
Yeah,
yes.
And the translation problems.
Yes, a very important question.
Because I, as a person, I'm not very familiar with the Japanese works, and different nations have different levels of acquaintance with the Japanese works. English, for example, people in England and people in Australia and the United States, everybody can read the translation with different backgrounds and the accumulation of the Japanese words. How did you make the target audience familiar, for example, about the footnotes in your translation, whatever? Thank you.
I put in a lot of footnotes. Which my publisher, I think, probably put at the bottom of the page where they belong. I never read any of those. So they're there. I put in a lot of supporting material. I have genealogical tables, maps, whatnot, in the back. I put in all the supporting material that I thought I could manage. I understood that this is not, strictly speaking, an academic publication for the university press. The question of the target audience is very worthwhile. My ambition when I translated The Tale of Genji was to have The Tale of Genji break out in the literary world from the rubric Japanese and into the larger category, literature. I don't think I really made it with Genji. Reviewers tended to be Japanese literature scholars. The one in the New York Times was a Japanese-American woman who reviews translations of Japanese literature. The New York Review of Books wouldn't review it. We don't do that stuff like that. They didn't do Heike either. However, I had the same ambition with, it's not that The Tale of Genji is unknown or anything, it was widely read, but as it was treated, my translation, of course my translation was the third, and it's getting to be a bit old hat, but it didn't really break out to being reviewed by literary figures who were not without a connection with Japan. Heike did. I was reviewed by very literary people who were not Japanese literature scholars, not involved in the business of Japanese literature. And I was very pleased to see that. At the same time, as in the case with The Tale of Genji, The Tale of Genji is so famous, but the reception of this work drives me mad, is all I can say, in English. I have some strong ideas about it. Never mind The Tale of Genji. the Tale of Taheke, too, reviewers were extremely enthusiastic, but they made, most of them made remarks about how, oh, this is such a different world, we're so unfamiliar with it, it's so foreign, and their remarks show. There was only one review that had no mistakes in it. That review was not the one at the LLB, by the way. It was the only review with no mistakes in it was by was entirely voluntary by an extraordinary man named David Bentley Hart. I don't think I'll get started on him. He made no mistakes whatsoever. It was the best review I ever got. But that sense of foreignness, the target audience feeling foreign, we don't know about Japan. Japan's foreign. We don't know about it. Therefore, what we're reading, we don't understand. We don't really understand it. We can't grasp it. People can think about it. And I entirely understand, of course, and my effort in doing DMG and AK and other things is to slowly bridge the gap or build a better road across. At the same time, I do feel that reading the Tale of the AK, which that prize committee certainly appreciated a great deal in my translation, I was amazed. Most readers seem to think, unless they're samurai buffs, seem to think that it's still very foreign. And I think, yes, what is it? What is essentially foreign about it on account of war and suffering in war? There is nothing essentially foreign about it for any of us, unfortunately. And so the trappings are different, the horses are different. The horses, by the way, are mysteries. There are two great mysteries in Haiti for me: how the horses could be so small, and how the work they got them into their boats and out of them. That's another story. But the brutality of war, it's all there, of course, but it's everywhere. What is foreign about that, unfortunately? But still, the trappings, the local color are different. That makes people feel, I don't understand this. Right. But I done my bit. Build a better bridge.
On that note, an excellent note. We should move on. So thank you very much, Robert.